Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila, Chapter 5, Text 18. Like the transcendental body of Lord Krishna, Gokula is all-pervading, infinite, and supreme. It expands both above and below without any restriction. Report by Srila Prabhupada. Srila Jiva Goswami, the great authority and philosopher in the line of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, has discussed the abode of Krishna in his Krishna Sandarbha. In Bhagavad Gita, the Lord also refers to my abode. Srila Jiva Goswami, examining the nature of Krishna's abode, refers to the Skanda Purana, which states, the abodes of Godhead in the material world, such as Dwarka, Mathura, and Gokula and Goloka, are facsimiles representing the abodes of Godhead in the kingdom of God by Vaikuntha Dham. The unlimited spiritual atmosphere of that Vaikuntha Dham is far above and beyond the material cosmos. This is confirmed in the Svayambhuva Tantra in a discussion between Lord Shiva and Parvati regarding the effect of chanting the mantra of 14 syllables. There it is stated, while chanting the mantra, one should always remember the spiritual world, which is very extensive and full of desire trees that can yield anything one desires. Below that Vaikuntha region is the potential material energy which causes the material manifestation. The places of the pastimes of Lord Krishna, such as Dwarka, Mathura, and Vrindavan, eternally and independently exist in Krishna Loka. They are the actual abode of Lord Krishna, and there is no doubt that they are situated above the material cosmic manifestation. The abode known as Vrindavan, or Gokula, is also known as Goloka. The Brahma Samhita describes that Gokula, the highest region of the kingdom of God, resembles a lotus flower with thousands of petals. The outer portion of that lotus-like planet is a square place known as Swetadvipa. In the inner portion of Gokula, there is an elaborate arrangement for Sri Krishna's residence with his eternal associates, such as Nanda and Yashoda. That transcendental abode exists by the energy of Sri Baladev, who is the original whole of Shesha or Ananta. The Tantras also confirm this description by stating that the abode of Sri Anantadev, the plenary portion of Baladev, is called the Kingdom of God. Vrindavan Dham is the innermost abode within the quadrangular realm of Swetadvipa, which lies outside the boundary of Gokula Vrindavan. According to Jiva Goswami, Vaikuntha is also called Brahmaloka. The Narada Pancharatna, in a statement concerning the mystery of Vijaya, describes, the predominator of the gopis, Govinda, the principal deity of Gokula, always enjoys himself in a place called Goloka, in the topmost part of the spiritual sky. From the authoritative evidence cited by Jiva Goswami, we may conclude that Krishna Loka is the supreme planet in the spiritual sky, which is far beyond the material cosmos. For the enjoyment of transcendental variety, the pastimes of Krishna there have three divisions, and these pastimes are performed in the three abodes of Dwarka, Mathura, and Gokula. When Krishna descends to this universe, he enjoys the pastimes in places of the same name. These places on earth are non-different from those original abodes, for they are facsimiles of those original holy places in the transcendental world. They are as good as Sri Krishna himself and are equally worshipable. Lord Chaitanya declared that Lord Krishna, who presents himself as the son of the king of Raja, is worshipable, and Vrindavan Dham is equally worshipable. So, in philosophy of Krishna consciousness, one very prominent feature is the idea of parallel realities. One can go to Vrindavan, for example, by purchasing a ticket. Well, you can go to Mathura at any rate, then take a rickshaw over to Vrindavan. But according to Vaishnava philosophy, the spiritual world is existing in Vrindavan. But most of us won't see that if we go there. So this is a parallel reality. Furthermore, the spiritual world that exists in Vrindavan is corresponding to, or it's a facsimile of, Srila Prabhupada uses this word facsimile, of the spiritual world, which is completely transcendental and beyond this material manifestation. Being transcendental, you may ask, well, where is it? Of course, what we see with these senses, by definition, is not transcendental. It's material. These senses are quite limited. So, for example, the sense of sight, of course, the modern explanation is that you have a lot of atoms, and the atoms give off photons of light, which are like little particles of light. And some of the photons enter your eye, and they're focused by the lens and so forth to form an image on the retina of the eye. And then there are more material actions and reactions that go on. You have nerve cells being stimulated by the photons, and then a bunch of chemical reactions occur in the cell, and an action potential is produced, and this goes traveling down an axon and goes into the brain, and then a lot of things like that happen. All sorts of things involving cells and electrical currents and so on. That's the modern understanding of what's going on. Now, how that results in seeing is a bit hard to understand. In fact, no one has the faintest idea how all those electrical impulses and chemical reactions and so forth result in seeing. Of course, you can understand how they might result in a reaction. Just like if you have a mouse trap set up with a spring, and you push down on the little lever, the catch is released and the thing snaps down. So, mechanically, you can see how a stimulus yields a response in a suitably organized material system. So, likewise, with all those billions of neurons in the brain and so forth, you can understand, at least in principle, how various impulses coming in through the nerves from the eye and other nerves in the body and so forth could result in a complicated reaction. And perhaps you could even explain human behavior in that way, including me sitting here talking. This could all be explained. You can break it down to little nerve impulses going through different cells and synapses and so forth. But the question comes, well, how is it that I'm aware of any of that? Why is there awareness there? For example, let's say you hear the sound of a violin. You can imagine what that sounds like. Well, that's certain nerve impulses in a certain part of the brain, in the area that the nerves from the ears project to. And you can imagine seeing a sunset, and that's nerve impulses in another region of the brain. Well, why is it that one set of nerve impulses produces the sound of a violin, and the other set of nerve impulses is producing the perception of the sunset? The answer would be no one has any idea. It's a total mystery. But it would seem that there's more to the human being than just the material body, namely all these cells with the nerve impulses and so on and so forth. There's something else there which is perceiving, because certainly scientists have spent a great deal of time and effort trying to understand the brain, and you can understand a lot of things going on in the brain, but they haven't the faintest idea what perception is, which at least is consistent with the idea that what is perceiving is something other than the brain. The reason they haven't been able to understand perception by looking at the brain is that the brain is not the thing that's perceiving. It's something else. So somehow we are something else which are which is perceiving through the apparatus of the body and the senses. So we actually belong to a different domain of existence. That would be the idea. And this perceiving is something being done by something other than the material apparatus. So that itself points to the possibility that in addition to this material continuum with its atoms and photons and so forth, there's another continuum in which we're actually existing, but somehow we've been linked up to this material continuum. Computers provide a nice analogy for this, especially the idea of virtual reality, which I guess hasn't made it commercially yet because computers aren't powerful enough. But there's the concept that you can have a computer simulation running which produces a complete world in which there are different things. There could be rivers and mountains and birds and trees and so forth. And your senses get linked up to the computer simulation. Namely, you're wearing goggles that have little TV screens in them, and you have earphones giving you sound produced by the computer. And you can even imagine a feeling system. You put your hand on a high-tech spheroid, and it pumps nerve impulses into your hand, which then produce the appropriate tactile sensations for being in some kind of world. So you're then projected into that world, and you're seeing what is in that world. This has been done crudely. You have people wearing these huge goggle arrangements, which must be quite a weight on their head. And they're wearing data gloves, which go over the hand so that when you move your fingers, the data is sent to the computer, and the hand of your simulated body is also moved. And so I saw once a simulation in which two people in a simulated world were shaking hands with each other. Actually, each person was sitting in a chair, and they were separated by about 20 feet. And each one had these gloves on and the goggles and so forth. And they were going through motions. But what they were seeing was that they were walking in these simulated bodies in this simulated room towards each other, reaching out and shaking hands. The only trouble was that the simulation wasn't good enough to have solid body contact, because it's too complicated. There's so many different ways the surfaces could touch each other. So their hands passed through each other when they tried to shake hands, which was a little bit of a letdown. But they were actually acting within that world, picking up sense data and then acting accordingly within a simulated world. So the idea would be similarly, we are transcendental entities, and we are perceiving what is going on in this world due to some sensory link-up, some data connection with considerable bandwidth, so that we see ourselves and perceive ourselves as acting and experiencing things within this world, even though we're not part of this world. So, what is that world then? So it would seem that there are different, you might say, levels of reality. There are various analogies to enable one to refer to this. You can speak of higher dimensions or different planes of reality. These are all metaphors to try to convey the idea. The concept of parallel world also is a metaphor, because the word parallel comes from geometry, where you can have two parallel lines which are right next to each other, but they don't touch. Nonetheless, they're in very close proximity. So similarly, there's this other world that we're actually part of, although we don't generally know it, which is parallel to this material world. So what is the nature of that world, and how does it link up with the material world anyway? Of course, with computers, your data link is some kind of cable, a coaxial cable. So we're talking about a much more subtle kind of data link. And again, in the whole realm of science, no one has any idea what that would be. It's completely beyond anyone's understanding. So there's the data link, and then there's the parallel reality. Now, this parallel reality apparently has rather complex structure. The first point to note is the material world is not the ultimate source of reality. That would be one concept. There's the idea that, well, the material world sort of gives off subtle parallel world in the same way that, the analogy was made of the liver producing bile or something like that. That was Darwin's analogy. You might know he would come up with something like that. Yes, well, he was saying the brain secretes thoughts just as the liver secretes bile. So the thing of it is, a thought is something rather different from bile, at least for some people. But in any case, so there's a concept which would say that the subtle level of reality is emanated from the material level. But what we find here is exactly the opposite, namely that there's an ultimate spiritual level of reality, you might say, and that tends to be infinitely expanding. So we have the description here of Gokula. By the way, Gokula and Goloka, apparently Kula basically means a group. Or in this case, a herd, because Gokula would be the group of cows. And Loka is like a world or a place where beings live. So Goloka would be the world of the cows. So there's an emphasis on cows here. So this Goloka is said to be all-pervading, infinite, and supreme. It expands both above and below without any restriction. So the lotus actually is in a way a natural metaphor for infinity, because you have spirals and spirals of petals, which could, of course, in any actual lotus, there's only a finite number, but you can imagine them spiraling in infinitely. In fact, a logarithmic spiral, which you see in plants, would in principle spiral in infinitely far. So in that sense, the center of a flower is like a symbol of infinity. But this lotus of Goloka or Gokula is infinite, and it expands in all directions. Of course, what do you mean in this case by directions? Actually, in the Brahma Samhita, it's described that the whole arrangement of the spiritual world is described in terms of three dimensions, namely 10 directions. The 10 directions are north, south, east, west, and then northeast, southeast, and so on, and that gives you 8, and then up and down, making 10. So that's how the description is given. But that would apparently be metaphorical, because those are not the directions that we know. So this Goloka expands in all directions. It consists of many realms in which Krishna is carrying out his different pastimes, and no doubt many other things completely beyond our imagination. Now, it's described here that there's a place called Swetadweep, which is just sort of outside the realm of this lotus, even though the lotus is all expanding and infinite, just outside of it. So how can that be if it's all expanding and infinite? There's this square region. It's interesting that the Swetadweep is square. But Swetadweep is associated with Anantadev, who's an expansion of Balaram. Now, In the material world, there is also a simulacrum or facsimile of Swetadweep. So you have the original Swetadweep and the Swetadweep in the material world. Srila Prabhupada has said a number of things about where that Swetadweep is. It's described as an island in the ocean of milk. So there's an ocean of milk in Bhumandala, in the region called Saptadvipa. That's a ring-shaped ocean, is the way it's described. So one possibility is that Swetadweep is there. But in another place, Srila Prabhupada says that on the Vaikuntha planet of Dhruva Loka, there's an ocean of milk, and Swetadweep is there. However, there's actually a third description. In one place, Srila Prabhupada cites the Lagu Bhagavatamrita, and that describes that there's the saltwater ocean and then the ocean of milk, and Swetadweep is located to the east of Meru in the ocean of milk. Even a dimension is given of 200,000 miles in that reference. This, by the way, doesn't refer to the order of the oceans given in the Bhagavatam, but there's a different order of the oceans given in the Siddhanta Shiromani and in the Matsya Purana. That information is given. But in any case, this Swetadweep is where Shiradakshay Vishnu is resting on Anantadev. That's where Brahma goes to inquire of, to pray to Lord Vishnu to resolve various difficulties in the material situation. So it's also described here, of course, that Vrindavan, Mathura, and Dwarka have their counterpart in the spiritual world, and there are spiritual facsimiles of those in the Vrindavan, Mathura, and Dwarka on the material, on this earth. So, those in turn being different from the mundane locations. I understand it also that there are celestial Vrindavan and Mathura and so forth. So just as there's the, you could go to Vrindavan on the gross physical level, and then you might go from there to the celestial Vrindavan, but that's still not the transcendental Vrindavan. There are many different levels of existence. And all of this, in one sense, is existing in the same place, which is another aspect, because Krishna is greater than the greatest and also smaller than the smallest, but where Krishna is, his entire abode is to be found, which would mean that it's all right here also, if you could only access the whole thing. Are there any questions? Yeah?
What you're describing about perception. So, you know, like Krishna in the spiritual world, but Krishna anywhere, he's not bound by, perceived by the senses, by the eyes, or the hearing, by the ears, or something. It's sort of like all knowledge, it's all perception. An answer or getting towards, you know, left the scientists or looking at that knowledge, perception, living entity, like that. But,
well, the thing I was saying about perception, to begin with, you see, we have this here, this idea of the parallel reality. There's a transcendental reality parallel to this material reality. The interesting thing is we're actually part of that transcendental reality. We think we're part of the material reality. So our senses are linked up to the material nature, but in relation to what you were saying, basically, that means a limitation on our sense perception. In other words, our natural sense perception would enable us to see the spiritual world and the material world. And it wouldn't limit us to, for example, seeing things through these gelatinous eyeballs. I mean, it is a rather curious thing. There's this eyeball. Well, there's a spherical shell. Inside there's the vitreous humor and so forth. There's this line from Shakespeare in the, King Lear. Out, out, vile jelly, and he pulls the guy's out, eye out with a hook. Where's thy muster now? So, well, it is rather odd that this ball of jelly could see in the first place. How does that work? One will say, well, you just pass the buck back to the brain. Well, you see, because the brain is doing something with the nerve impulses that are sent in by the eye. Well, that's a glob of jelly also. So how does that see? So somehow our seeing, it would appear, is a restriction of the natural spiritual seeing, so that it's limited to what a certain glob of jelly is doing. It's a very unusual situation. So, there are descriptions in out-of-body experiences and so forth that people's seeing becomes much less restricted. In other words, they can see what's going on in the other room, for example. There's the case of this lady who had an out-of-body experience from a heart attack or something like that. And when she regained consciousness, she said that, you know, this hospital is filthy. You know, I was looking up on top of the lights. There are all these bugs and dirt up there. And out on this window ledge up on such and such floor, there are these tennis shoes laying on the ledge. I mean, this is supposed to be a place where, you know, you recover from illness and so forth. And, of course, people were a little bit shocked about that. But someone went to check, and they found the tennis shoes were on the ledge. Up on some floor, and the only way you could see that was you had to go up to the appropriate place and lean way out the window and look around, and then you could see them. So how could she see that? Because she was confined to her bed and had had a heart attack. So even there appears to be a subtle platform of seeing which is much less restricted than our physical seeing. I'd still be interested in finding out about out-of-body experiences by blind people. That would be interesting, especially if someone is congenitally blind, that is, from birth. What would happen if they have an out-of-body experience? But beyond that, there's a spiritual level of seeing in which you could actually see Goloka and enter into that and so forth. Yeah?
I use the term parallel reality or higher level. So in science or higher, they use the term dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So how is this relate and where we should fit in to reality? What's the connecting feature of dimensions?
Well, the difficult thing is to understand how the material world can connect to some higher reality. Now, physics tends to be presented as a self-contained system. That's the problem. That's one of the main causes for, you might say, atheism within science. Because the physicists write down their equations describing different entities such as electromagnetic fields and things like that. And it's a closed system. There's no way out. Actually, it's kind of ironic, but the Big Bang theory offered a way out because the Big Bang starts with a singularity. And at a singularity, by definition, all the mathematics breaks down. So at that point, anything goes. So Stephen Hawking, the famous crippled scientist, went to a lot of effort to patch that singularity so that as you approach the singularity, instead of coming to a singularity where everything breaks down, you sort of zip around in another dimension and come back out again in a smooth continuum. So then the whole thing becomes seamless again. And he called this the no boundary theory. So the idea then is there's no room for God because the material system is a seamless continuum, and you just go here, there, within it. It's like being restricted to the surface of a sphere, and you just go around and around this way and that, and all you see is the surface of the sphere. And in fact, that's all there is. So that means no room for God or any of this spiritual stuff. And there you are. It's left to the neurophysiologist to explain somehow how all these nerve impulses then give rise to perception. So it would seem that there must be some limit to the physics. It's not being presented properly. Now, in one sense, if you look at physics from a historical standpoint, you can see that there's good reason to think that it's subject to different limitations because it keeps changing with time. So right now, the latest thing in physics is to try and figure out this so-called superstring theory. Oddly enough, superstring theory is based on the idea that instead of particles moving in three-dimensional space, where a particle is like a little point and it moves around in space, what you have are little vibrating strings, almost like the string of a guitar, that vibrate in different harmonics, but they vibrate within 10-dimensional space. Because in order to explain all the things that they needed to explain, they had to have 10 different degrees of freedom for the thing to vibrate in. Now, the way they get rid of the other six dimensions, because you've got three dimensions of space and one of time, and then they've added six more. Well, they curl them up into a tiny little ball. Let's see how to explain this. Just like if you take a sheet, a square, so that has two dimensions. But imagine curling it into a tube, like a very thin drinking straw. It still has two dimensions, but if you stand back from it, it seems to be just a one-dimensional line. So they say, similarly, you take the extra six dimensions and curve them into a tiny little tube, which you can't see because it's too small. So in this way, you've got 10 dimensions, but you can only see or experience four of them. This is what they try to do. But what if it's very recently that they've introduced these 10 dimensions, I think since about the 1980s, really. So then what else may they introduce at some future point? So the system that we're part of materially could be part of something much bigger, part of a larger continuum going off in different dimensions. So in that sense, this is just a limited sub-continuum, you might say. Then, of course, this is all within the realm of duality. That's another thing. In the spiritual world, everything is connected. In the material world, things are, let's say, loosely connected, just like the pieces of this microphone. They can all come apart, and they're just separate pieces. Eventually, you can break the thing down into atoms, and they're just separate little atoms. But in the spiritual world, everything is integrally unified and connected. So Krishna's limbs are all interchangeable. It's said he can perform the action of one limb with another limb, and so forth. So how this interconnectedness relates to the material continuum, where things are all split up, is another mysterious area. But there's a lot of room, I think, for further expansion of physics. Yeah?
Yes, could you say something about the power of God as far as creating or helping to manifest our present reality? And what does it mean to become co-creators with God?
Become co-creators with God. Well, it said man proposes and God disposes. That phrase is there. Which means that we do have a capacity as co-creators. If we imagine a certain state of affairs, then God may bring that about for us. Even though it may not be even the best thing. Still, that may be brought about. So you have people today putting tremendous imagination and willpower into developing different kinds of technology. So you have this fantastic development of technology, which historically doesn't even make sense. I mean, for thousands of years, people were doing things in a certain pretty limited way, and now they're creating computers with gigabytes of memory and all this kind of thing. That's a bit odd. You'd think the characters who were content to chip flints for hundreds of thousands of years would not suddenly be creating computers within, you know, 50 years, let's say. But it's happening. So it would seem some input of higher information is taking place, but people are desiring it. Now, people might be well advised to desire something a bit different, but you get what you ask for ultimately. You are authorized to show confidence.